hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who is a partner in the law firm of Abrahams & Festerman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, concentrating on the areas of mental health and healthcare law. She's also the founder and president of Campus Behavioral Health Risk Consultants and is a former hospital administrator and director of hospital risk management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And I'm interested in talking about the irony in this country that it is so difficult to get mental health care, yet so easy to get guns. And we've just had another incident of somebody that had mental health issues that was responsible for the murder of 12 people at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. And you can go back to the Virginia Tech shooting, that the shooter had mental health issues. And clearly the shooter at Sandy Hook more recently, who killed all those young school children, had mental health issues. So let's start with that question. Why is it so difficult to get mental health treatment in this country and so easy to get guns?
I think it's a matter of priority, and I think it's about who screams the loudest and who has the most clout, certainly in our national Congress. You know, it's a very strong gun lobby. It's not, unfortunately, a very strong lobby for mental health services. You know, over the years, there's been a lot of stigma, a lot of blaming. Certainly these incidents are unfortunate, not only for the victims, certainly, but it adds to the stigma of equating, you know, mental illness with people who are violent. In fact, statistically, people with serious mental illness are more often the victims of violence than the perpetrators. But certainly this highlights the issue of, you know, a very tragic situation, and then you go back and look, and it's somebody who has some sort of mental illness or mental health history.
So what kind of regime could be put in place? Just for a moment, imagining that the NRA doesn't exist and that we lived in a perfect world where the rights of citizens not to be murdered at their workplace was equal to the rights of citizens who feel they have constitutional right to carry firearms. So what kind of regime could you work out that would protect the rights of the mentally ill at the same time protect the broader public?
Well, mental illness is treatable. People can recover, although it's not a curable illness. And we have seen, and, you know, statistics bear it out as well as the clinical researchers, that if mental illness is treated early on, if people have insight into their illness, if they stay in treatment, if they're compliant with medications or other forms of treatment, they can be stabilized and they can, you know, work safely in the community, live and work. And so I think first and foremost, we need to shift all our priorities into funding for mental illness the same way as we fund medical illnesses, diabetes, cardiac illnesses, cancer. Not that those aren't important illnesses that need funding and attention also, but we tend not to fund and to do the adequate research we need in the mental health area. So certainly that's first and foremost, is funding for these services, not only in terms of treatment itself, but supportive services.
So would it be okay with you for a psychiatrist who's treating a patient to make some reference to, I guess it's the FBI that have the database on whether you can buy a gun? What's your sense of how that intersection can be constructed?
I think part of the problem with the gun legislation that we've seen in sort of a knee-jerk reaction, certainly after Aurora and then absolutely following the Newtown tragedy, is that we set up these systems to report people who are making certain statements or have a certain mental health history into a database. But putting a name into a database with the hope that it'll prevent someone from buying a gun doesn't address the real fundamental underlying issues that we face in this country. It doesn't provide funding. It doesn't provide support services. It doesn't provide housing. In other words, you put a name into a database, and then what? You're not addressing the core issue, which is treatment and prevention. And so putting a name in a database is something that everybody thinks is a great idea. But not only does it not provide services or any constructive assistance to people who have mental illness, it also, and this is the fear for those of us who work in this area, is that it'll chill the effect of people going for treatment. If someone goes to their mental health professional and talks about being, talks about or thinking about hurting themselves or hurting someone else, if they know they're going to get the name in a database, our concern is that they won't go for treatment or they won't talk freely. I mean, that's the whole basis for our confidentiality laws, so that people will go and seek a medical or psychiatric assistance, knowing that they're free to speak about what their issues are, and hopefully the goal is to get intervention and treatment.
Again, I'm speaking with Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who's a partner in the law firm of Abrahams and Fensterman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice. And you mentioned the Aurora shooter that I didn't mention in the opening. He, of course, pleaded guilty on the basis of mental illness. And in his case, you get the impression that the parents, and particularly the healthcare professionals at the university, where he was getting treatment, somehow dropped the ball. In the case of Sandy Hook, the mother, of course, was the first victim. The son killed the mother, but he clearly had mental health issues. Is the problem that, in effect, you're requiring those closest, the next of kin, the parents of somebody that's exhibiting mental illness, to sort of basically turn their kids in?
Well, it actually, in real life, works in reverse. I mean, the bulk of my practice is working with individuals and families and loved ones of people who have mental illness and are at a loss to not only know how to navigate through the mental health system, but have very little on the receiving end when they want to seek treatment, either themselves or for their loved ones. And so what you have is families who live with persons with this illness, who want to get assistance for them, recognize the issues, want treatment, but are either turned away because of our confidentiality laws. Basically, there's a wall that gets put up that says, we can't talk to you about any of this. There's a wall that's put up on our very strict involuntary commitment laws, so that families can't get someone hospitalized, for example, when they know they're really sick and need an acute level of care. So, in fact, families don't turn the other way. They want treatment. They want input. They want assistance. But there's so little on the receiving end of seeking that kind of treatment and assistance. The other issue that you raise is that if we can identify people in our workplaces, in our schools, in our community, of whom we are concerned, there are systems that you can set up for identifying them within the system in which you work. For example, in a workplace, we set up teams who are there to have to receive input from those closest to the individual about how they're concerned, how they're hearing things that sound a little bit unusual, for example, that are set up to acknowledge that and know how to follow up on those concerns. You can train lay people to identify what I call red flag behaviors in a workplace, on a college campus, for example, or even in a lower school. And in a very constructive, supportive way, you can take that information and triage it, know who's at most risk and what may be minimal risk, and then seek assistance for that person early on, again, before it escalates any further. So, but we see very little of these teams. Certainly we see them rarely, if ever, in a workplace setting. We're seeing them more on college campuses. They're a very successful way to obtain information and to seek a response and a constructive input and support for people about whom we're concerned before it escalates.
So let's deal with these two hypotheticals, red flag warnings at the workplace and red flag warnings at the home. Say your own child is exhibiting antisocial and dangerous behavior. Let's start with that. You're saying that if the parent tries to get help, they get nowhere. Is it because the only person who can flag this person is a psychiatrist and that confidentiality laws prevent parents from getting help? Is that what you told us?
Well, it prevents them often from getting information that they may be able to use in order to get assistance for their loved one, for example. Or the involuntary commitment laws are so stringent. You know, it's basically a danger to self or others and has a mental illness. We're actually in my office drafting proposed legislation which would modify that standard to look at whether a person has a prior history where they were hospitalized and benefited from the treatment, where there's a care and treatment benefit to being in the mental health system and getting services, so that we recognize that not only do they benefit from services, but there are services available, and you know that may be the only way to get them. The same for the confidentiality laws. If we can make families and loved ones part of the treatment team, we can fall into one of the exceptions to these confidentiality laws, and that family can be part of the treatment team. They know what's going on in the home. They know what's going on in the school setting sometimes, so that we have more communication, not from a negative standpoint, but from a very positive, supportive advocacy standpoint by the people who know the individual best and see them on a daily basis.
So how much then, I mean, obviously these protections are very, very important. I mean, there have been incidents, obviously, quite common for parents to give their children drugs and the kid just may be a spirited individual. And then you've had cases of families when there's a inheritance involved, basically trying to commit other members of the family in order to get the money. I mean, these are, they sound like Hollywood movies, I know, but they do happen in real life. And presumably the laws are in there to protect the individual against that kind of abuse. So how do you balance this out?
Well, I think the number of times that that's the case is certainly smaller than the number of times families love and care about the individual and want them to be in treatment and want it to be from a very loving and supportive perspective. But as we continue to see these tragedies unfold, I think we need as a country to look at how do we balance privacy and individual rights with safety and security of the community. And so there has to be some give and take here. I absolutely believe that there should be confidentiality and privacy, but clearly that hasn't worked as it sits right now because we see so many of these incidents recently, and we also know that with the proper care and treatment and early intervention, we likely can prevent these tragedies, certainly, and also prevent people from suffering from an illness that, again, is treatable. So I think we need to look at shifting the balance, as I said, between privacy and individual rights with now the broader safety and security of our communities at large.
So just in closing, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, in terms of our culture, as opposed to the lack of mental health services and the easy access to guns, which is the recipe for the kind of continuing massacres that we have in this country, as a culture, movies, etc., television, you can't escape a television or a movie without a gun being pointed at you. And I think young people in this country grow up with an idea that guns solve problems as opposed to create tragedies. And there's also an association with guns and manliness. I come from a culture in Australia where anybody who pulls a gun or a knife in a fight is considered an abject coward. But in this culture, you're a hero if you have a gun. Is that something that we should be addressing?
Absolutely. I think we have become very sensitized to the violence, the video games, the constant bombardment of tragedies or of shootings, you know, over and over, the internet certainly. So I think our young people have become very sensitized to the violence. I think you're right. I think guns have kind of been romanticized in movies or in games and so on. And I think we need to begin to look very hard at that and come back to the reality of what guns are. They hurt people. They kill people. Not only the individual who is hurt or maimed or killed, but I think we also need to start talking about what does it do to the survivors. We don't talk about what about those families that are now faced with a loss of their loved one or a paralyzed loved one or a compromised loved one. We need to, again, expand the discussion and expand the picture into the realities of what happens on the receiving end of this.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf.
Thank you for inviting me.
And again, I've been speaking with Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who's a partner in the law firm of Abrahams & Fensterman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, concentrating in the areas of mental health and healthcare law. She's also the founder and president of Campus Behavioral Risk Consultants and is a former hospital administrator and director of hospital risk management. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the latest census figures on poverty in America.